On the 7th of December 1949, Stalin arrived back in Moscow in time for two momentous events: the arrival of the new Chinese leader, Chairman Mao Zedong, and the celebration of his 70th birthday. Mao and Stalin met for the first time at the Little Corner. The two communist titans of the century, both fanatics, poets, paranoics, peasants, risen to rule empires whose history obsessed them, careless killers of millions and amateur military commanders, aimed to seal America's worst nightmare, a Sino-Soviet treaty that would be Stalin's last significant achievement. Yet they observed each other coolly from the Olympian heights of their own self-regard. Mao complained of being pushed aside for a long time. "The victors are never blamed," answered Stalin. "Any ideas or wishes?" "We've come to complete a certain task," said Mao. "It must be both beautiful and tasty." A cantankerous silence followed. Stalin appeared baffled by this enigmatic allusion, which meant a treaty that was both symbolic and practical. Stalin's first priority was protecting his Far Eastern gains, agreed at Yalta. Mao wished to save face before signing away Chinese lands. This was stalemate. Mao suggested summoning Chou Enlai, his premier, to complete the negotiations. "If we cannot establish what we must complete, why call for Chou?" asked Stalin. They parted. Mao remained miserably in Moscow for several weeks before the two sides came together, grumbling bitterly that there was nothing to do there but eat, sleep, and shit. The prim Russians were shocked at Mao's scatological jokes, both in person and on their bugs. Mao was not completely ignored. Molotov, Bulganin, and Mikoyan visited him at the dacha. Like an abbot testing a novice, Molotov patronizingly tested Mao's Marxist knowledge, deciding the chairman was a clever man, a peasant leader, but not a real Marxist. After all, Molotov repeated prissily to Stalin, Mao confessed he had never read Das Kapital. On the 21st of December, Mao and the entire communist world gathered at the Bolshoi to celebrate the birthday of their supreme pontiff. Something between a religious pilgrimage and an imperial triumph, a royal wedding and a corporate junket, the festivities cost 5.6 million rubles and attracted thousands of pilgrims. Stalin, torn between contempt for their worship and craving for it, played the modest curmudgeon as Malenkov tried to persuade him that the people expected a celebration and more medals. "Don't even think of presenting me with another star," he growled. "But Comrade Stalin, the people..." "Leave the people out of it." In Pravda, Khrushchev hailed Stalin's sharp intransigence to rootless cosmopolitans, in other words, the Jews. Paskryobyshev praised Stalin's brilliance at growing lemons. The wives of the magnates brought presents. Nina Beria made walnut jam as a little souvenir of your mother, to which Stalin wrote a thank you letter. "As I eat your jam, I remember my youth." Beria rolled his eyes. "Now you'll be lined up for this chore every year." Famous artists and elite children rehearsed their tributes. Parents had never been pushier. Paskryobyshev managed to land his daughter, Natasha, the plum role of reciting an idolatrous ditty, then presenting Stalin, who had ordered the death of her mother, with a bouquet. At the Little Corner, the night before, Stalin changed the Bolshoi placement so that he was no longer in the center, but Malenkov insisted he had to be in the front row. He pointedly placed himself between Mao and Khrushchev, the new favorite. He felt pressure on his neck, then staggered from a dizzy spell, but Paskryobyshev steadied him. He would not call the doctors. Paskryobyshev, the former nurse, prescribed a remedy. The next night, the packed Bolshoi awaited the magnates. Stalin's exotic entourage, including Mao, Ulbricht of Germany, Rakosi of Hungary, and Bierut of Poland, trooped out, and the audience applauded madly. Stalin sat to the left of center, under a jungle of scarlet banners and a giant portrait of himself. Then the endless speeches began. Finally, on the 2nd of January, Stalin sent Molotov and Mikoyan to begin negotiations with Mao. Chou Enlai arrived to join the talks with the new foreign minister, Vyshinsky. The Chinese were invited to the Kremlin only to be reprimanded by Stalin for not signing a critique of a recent speech by U.S. Secretary of State Dean Acheson. When Mao grumbled about Stalin's resistance to the treaty, Stalin retorted, "To hell with that. We must go all the way." Mao sulked. In the limousine out to Kuntsevo, the Chinese interpreter invited Stalin to visit Mao. "Swallow your words," Mao hissed in Chinese to the interpreter. "Don't invite him." Neither of the titans spoke for the entire 30-minute drive. When Stalin invited Mao to dance to his gramophone, a singular honor for a visiting leader, he refused. It did not matter. The game of poker was over. While reserving for himself the supreme priesthood of international communism, Stalin allowed Mao a leading role in Asia. At the banquet to celebrate the signing of the treaty, Stalin pointedly denounced Titoism, and Mao continued his heroic sulk. The two giants barely spoke. Sporadic exchanges subsided into endless pauses. Gromyko struggled to keep the conversation going. Stalin may not have liked Mao, but he was impressed. Of the Marxist world, the most outstanding is Mao. Everything in his Marxist-Leninist life shows principles and drive, a coherent fighter. The alliance was immediately tested on the battlefields of Korea. Kim Il-sung, the young leader of communist North Korea, now arrived in Moscow to ask Stalin's permission to invade South Korea. Stalin encouraged Kim, but shrewdly told the Korean he could only get down to action after consulting with Comrade Mao Zedong personally. In Peking, the nervous Mao referred back to Stalin. On the 14th of May, Stalin cunningly replied, "The question should ultimately be decided by the Chinese and Korean comrades together." He thus protected his dominant role, but passed the responsibility. Nonetheless, his magnates were worried by his reckless challenge to America and failing powers of judgment. On the 5th of August, a weary, aging Stalin departed by special train for his longest holiday so far. It was to last 4.5 months. While the old generalissimo basked in the sun, pulling the strings in Korea, he was also killing his own men. On the 29th of September, Kuznetsov and Voznesensky were tried at the officers' club in Leningrad before an MGB audience. Before the trial finally started, the accused were ordered to leave Zhdanov out of their testimony. The main accused were sentenced to death by shooting next day, and the Politburo endorsed the sentences. "He'd sign first," admitted Khrushchev, "and then pass it round for the rest of us to sign. We'd sign without even looking." Did they sign the death list over dinner on the veranda? Kuznetsov defiantly refused to confess, which outraged Stalin and embarrassed Abakumov. "I'm a Bolshevik, and remain one in spite of the sentence I've received. History will justify us." After Stalin's death, Rada Khrushcheva asked what had happened to Kuznetsov. "He died terribly," replied her father, "with a hook through his neck." Voznesensky froze to death in the back of a prison truck in sub-zero temperatures. This little massacre consolidated the power of Malenkov, Beria, Khrushchev, and Bulganin, the last men standing as Stalin entered his final years, but it was the swan song of Abakumov. Stalin was now orchestrating another anti-Semitic spasm from his holiday villa. The Jewish managers of the plant that made his limousines had sent Mikoyles a telegram celebrating the foundation of Israel. "The good workers of the factory should be given clubs so they can beat the hell out of those Jews at the end of the working day," Stalin told Khrushchev. Khrushchev, Malenkov, and Beria summoned the managers to the Kremlin and accused them of complicity in an anti-Soviet Jewish nationalistic sabotage group. One terrified manager fainted. The three magnates had to resuscitate him with cold water. Stalin ordered his release, but two Jewish journalists who had written about the factory were executed. Stalin's personal intervention made the difference between life and death. Another Jewish manager, Salzman, was saved because during the war he had sent Stalin a desk set shaped like a tank, with the pens forming the guns.